Hello and welcome to World Business Report here from the BBC World Service. I'm Rahul Tan, and plenty coming up on this edition. As always, as Denmark introduces the world's first flatulence tax for gassy cows.
It'll be a tax implemented from 2030 until 2035. It'll be fully implemented, and then you have to pay for these emissions.
We'll be telling you why that tax has been put in place, and we'll find out a lot more about the US's next energy Secretary. But we are going to start the program by looking in depth at the G20 summit, which is being hosted in Brazil. Here on World Business Report, we try and explain what these summits are all about and actually who is taking part in them. So here's our World Business reporter, Bisi Adebayo.
The G20, or Group of 20, unites the world's largest economies, including major players like the US, China, the EU, as well as Argentina, Turkey, and newer additions like the African Union. Its members include two-thirds of the world's population and make up over 75% of world trade. This means it can seek to have significant influence over global issues like financial stability, trade, and climate policy-shaping decisions that impact everyday life. Starting after the Asian financial crisis in 1999, the G20 grew into a leader summit in 2008 during the global financial crisis, giving heads of state the opportunity to address complex challenges face-to-face. This week in Rio de Janeiro, Brazil, the summit is focusing on social inclusion, energy transitions, and global governance, launching initiatives like the Global Alliance Against Hunger and Poverty. And its expansion to include the African Union means a more prominent voice for the Global South.
Bisi, they're explaining some of the issues. We're going to look at one or two of them in a little bit more detail. But it's fair to say that the G20 has a shadow over it with the issue of Donald Trump's forthcoming return to the White House really dominating lots of the conversations there. But as Bisi said, President Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva has opened that summit in Rio de Janeiro. And one of the issues he wanted to focus on was that global alliance to combat poverty and hunger that's now backed by more than 80 countries.
It falls to those gathered around this table to tackle the urgent task of ending this scourge that shames humanity. For this reason, we've made the launch of a global alliance against hunger and poverty the central goal of Brazil's G20 presidency.
Okay, so that is one of the goals, but how is it going to be achieved? I've been getting some answers from Bruno de Conte. He's professor at the Institute of Economics at the State University of Campinas in Sao Paulo.
One of the consensus which was reached, or almost consensus, was that it's necessary to tax the riches or the super riches. This is one of the big things happening in the Brazilian chairmanship, but then we don't know concretely what will happen because the countries agreed. There is Argentina, I said almost consensus because Argentina is trying to create some trouble on that. But having consensus is one thing, and then designing policies in order to indeed tax their super rich is something that we have to see how it will be done.
They produced a report, didn't they, in June, looking at how that would work. And you've raised another issue now. You have President Milei. We have Donald Trump also as the next president of the US. They are going to block any attempts to put in a global wealth tax, aren't they?
It's true. Actually, now Milei has a big ally, which is Trump. And then this is one of the issues in which they will try to show very clearly that they are against multilateralism, right? So they have this idea that they have to defend their countries, first of all. In all institutions, G20 is only one of them. All multilateral groups or institutions, they will try to block initiatives. And then something that may happen, which may be not what they are planning to do, is that it will strengthen alternative groups such as the BRICS, because one of the important things of the G20 is precisely that it reunites countries from the global south and the global north trying to reach consensus or go in the same direction. Since the G20 becomes weaker, and it can become weaker because of Milei, but obviously more importantly because of Trump, then possibly it will give more strength to the BRICS. Let's see.
It's an interesting point that you raised there, because we've had Brazil, which has had the chairmanship of the G20. We had India as well, which had the chairmanship of the G20. Different sorts of economies running it. Has it made much of a difference to some of the policies that the G20 is looking at?
So actually, Brazilian chairmanship is the third one in a row. But it's true that at the end of the day, we don't have concrete decisions that were made in Brazil in regard to tackling the inequalities. So it's true that at the end, we are not having concrete results for tackling with this very important problem.
Isn't one of the problems with the G20 that you may, even though it's very difficult, eventually reach a consensus on some issues? But the difficulty then is the bigger, more powerful countries like the US, if they just say we're not going to do it, there's nothing much that the G20 can do about that.
It's true. It's true. Actually, in many multilateral institutions, one of the problems is the enforcement, right? So even if, well, the countries sign a kind of an agreement, at the end, there is no such supranational institution which may simply enforce those wills. So at the end, sometimes they are wills, but rhetorically they are put at important things. But nobody can, let's say, do the surveillance if those roads are being used to tackle with the important problems of the world.
We talk about the G20 not producing concrete policies. We now have the Global Alliance Against Hunger and Starvation. That is something positive that some would say that has come out of this G20. But how is that going to work? How's it going to be funded?
Yes, that's the point. That's what I say, that, well, so far we still only have a few funds coming from the Inter-American Development Bank. For Latin America, it's a very little fund. But I do hope that the other financial institutions we joined the alliance will put more money on the table. Let's see. And besides that, there is the promise of sharing technology and social technology related to those policies to struggle against starvation. So, and then Brazil has a policy which was widely recognized as a good policy, Bolsa Família. So that's why Lula is also so keen in this initiative, because he wants to, let's say, make this policy global. China, we have to recognize that in terms of fighting against poverty, they are successful. So sharing those policies is already something, but you are totally right that the most important thing is having funds.
Interesting to hear Bruno De Conti there. Let us bring in Peter Jankauskas, who is Vice President, Research and Analysis, Arbor Financial Services in Chicago. Peter, thanks for joining us here on the program. There are a lot of things that the G20 leaders are discussing, but because we're probably going to see quite a big shift in global economic policies with Donald Trump coming into power, it makes those discussions tricky, doesn't it?
It does. As been pointed out, you really need funding and enforcement for many of these measures. And if the largest economy of the world is not participating, that's going to be tough to achieve.
But on the other hand, we do, a lot of people say, look, these are just talking shops. They don't ever achieve very much. But the fact that you have the leaders of the world's great economies all together, that has to lead to something, doesn't it? Even if they're having conversations that in the short term don't lead to policies, in the longer term, it makes them understand that they could be on the same page on some issues, maybe not on others.
Yeah, I think it's definitely worthwhile for them to work toward establishing some common ground. Even if nothing concrete comes out of it, those relationships themselves are valuable and in times of crisis can certainly be the building block for consensus to take emergency actions.
Now, we are keeping a close eye on Donald Trump's next cabinet and those key economic positions. Peter, Treasury Secretary, the person who's going to run that U.S. economy, the world's biggest economy, a crucial position, still seems very unclear at the moment with lots of jockeying about who it could be.
Yes, indeed. There still is a great deal of uncertainty there. I think there's also uncertainty with many of the names that have already been put forth as to whether or not the Senate will actually approve some of these individuals. For example, the nominee for the Justice Department is questionable. The nominee for Health and Human Services is questionable. So we'll just have to see how this all plays out within the Congress.
Yeah. Scott Besson, hedge fund manager, Howard Lutnick, co-chair of Donald Trump's transition team, the names in the fray. So uncertainty there. But we do know who the next energy secretary is going to be.
President-elect Trump is not wasting any time filling his cabinet. This weekend, he announced his pick for energy secretary, fracking executive Chris Wright, who's a fierce critic.
So, Chris Wright there. Let's find out a little bit more about some of the policies we could see him putting into place. I'm delighted to say I'm joined by Mike Eastman. He's CEO of Tall City, an oil and gas company headquartered in Midland, Texas, a firm focused on exploratory fracking. Mike, thanks so much for joining us here on World Business Report. What do you make of this appointment, and what do you know in terms of about the new energy secretary? I'm sure he's somebody that you may have come across.
I haven't met him before. I've worked with his company when we fracked some wells in the Delaware Basin a couple of years ago. They did a great job, but I'm excited about the pick. He's apparently a great businessman. I've read some of the things that he's written. He put out a report last year, I think it was entitled Bettering Human Lives, and I agreed with about everything I read in that report. I know he's a strong advocate for providing more energy for the world, and the world needs it. So I think he's going, I'm excited about the pick and look forward to seeing what he can do in the post.
The world does need more energy. It's something that we talk about a lot of the time. There is this discussion, isn't there, about whether fossil fuels are the right way to go around providing much of that energy. Do you understand the worries that many people have because of some of the comments that he's made in the past around climate change?
I don't fully understand their concerns about that, but what I also don't understand is the fact that 80% of our energy now comes from fossil fuels. It's just not an option to do without it. And I hope that this new secretary will be an advocate for all forms of energy. Yeah. I think he will. But I think he realizes the fact of the matter is that fossil fuels are going to be here a long, long time, which the International Energy Agency and the United States EIA also predict. I think the forecast is that in 2050, both agencies believe we'll be using more fossil fuels than we use today.
Should we be? Should we be moving away from them quicker than we are? I know that you're somebody who's in the oil and gas industry, but you know what are your views in terms of the damage that fossil fuels may provide to the climate? Because there's increasing scientific evidence that they do, isn't it?
I just don't think we have any option. I don't think if we stopped it and decided we're going to replace it with another form, there's any other option out there. The one that might be a dense enough source of energy to make a big dent is nuclear, and it has its own problems too.
We've heard from Donald Trump, haven't we, during the campaign, that phrase that a lot of people are requoting, drill, baby, drill. You're there in Texas, you know, at the heart of the U.S. oil and gas industry. Are you expecting to see more licenses being granted for the industry that you're in, fracking, in the next few years?
You know, I really don't expect a big ramp up in activity myself. I think the new administration can reduce some of the costly regulations. I think they can bring some reasonableness to the EPA and perhaps some of the Endangered Species Act. I think they can help address, with their pro-energy stance, some capital concerns. And I think they can expand the LNG exports. You know, Europe is still buying about a BCF day from Russia. You need to get that gas from the United States. But given that, the big companies, particularly the publics, have already found a balance between distributions and buying back stock and reinvestment, and they're very disciplined in that. I really don't expect a huge increase in the number of wells that are being drilled.
That is interesting. Stay with us if you don't mind. I want to bring Peter Jankowskis back in here. That LNG, liquid gas, is such an important commodity globally. Do you think we are likely to see more exports out of the U.S. under Donald Trump?
I think so, yes. One, obviously, because there is a desire to increase energy production overall. And second, I think for strategic reasons, we're going to need to provide that sort of assistance to our allies that are dependent on sources that may not be as reliable.
Going back to you on this one, Mike, we saw President Biden, didn't we? He halted that LNG, liquefied natural gas exports. What sort of impact did that have on companies around you?
Well, we've got an abundance of gas in the Permian Basin. In fact, on our last month, our gas price was negative at the wellhead, if you can get your head around that. We paid money for our gas to go away. That's how much gas there is in the system out here. And so I'm really hoping we can expand those facilities. And that just boggles my mind when I realize that we're still buying gas from Russia. That's a strategic imperative that we should not be doing that, because we know right where those funds are going when he gets a hold of them. We need to be supplying that gas, and I think we can, but it takes a little time to expand those facilities and get it all on track, and I hope the new administration will make that a priority.
Mike, thanks so much for joining us here on World Business Reports there with his views on the new energy secretary and also how that could shape the US's energy policy. As the world's biggest economy, world's biggest producer of fossil fuels, it will also have a huge impact on the global economy as well. Give us your thoughts on that. You can contact us on WhatsApp or send us a voice note, +44 330 678 3033. We'd love to hear from you on that issue or any others you'd like to talk to us about. You're with World Business Report from the BBC World Service. Right, we are going to continue talking about emissions, because we talk a lot about the cost of them on this programme, from vehicles, from industry, from fossil fuels. But also, we have, over the last few months, closely been following this story.
Flatulence can be expensive in Denmark.
Livestock farmers will soon be taxed for the gassiness of their cows, sheep and pigs.
Well, we know that Denmark has now formally announced the world's first tax on emissions by livestock. That happened on Monday. From 2030, farmers will have to pay for the methane produced by their cows and pigs. I've been chatting with the Green Tripartite Minister in Denmark. They've helped to bring in these proposals. Jeppe Bruce, a little earlier.
We'll be the first country in the world to do a CO2 emission tax on livestock. And it'll be a tax implemented from 2030 until 2035. It'll be fully implemented. And it works that, you know, the way that you figure out how much emissions are there from a cow or from a pig, and then you will translate that into an emission factor, and then you have to pay for these emissions. And to reduce your emissions, you can actually invest in, you know, new stables or provide different kinds of foods that will reduce emissions. And so we're also working on to do new ways of actually to reduce emissions from your livestock.
And it's a sliding scale, isn't it? So what will be in place in 2030, that tax on emissions, will be much greater in 2035.
Yeah, it'll be increasing until it's fully implemented by 2035.
You are the first country to put this in place. How important a moment do you think it is in that battle against emissions? And just for our listeners, give an indication in Denmark, how much of those emissions are coming from livestock?
Well, if you look at today, we have a goal in Denmark to reduce 70% of our emissions by 2030 compared to 1990. And we already did taxes on transportation sector, and we did a CO2 emission tax on Danish industries. And today, the emissions from the agricultural sector is around 1/3 of all emissions from Denmark. By 2030, it will be half of all emissions, since other sectors are going down. And therefore, we need to do much more to reduce emissions from the agricultural sector in Denmark. Also because we are one of the countries in the world with the largest land to be producing agricultural food for pigs or for livestock. Around 60% of the Danish area is actually in place for the agricultural sector.
Yeah, you're up there with Bangladesh, aren't you? The two highest in the world.
Yeah.
What will happen, though, do you think, long term? Are you hoping that these farmers transition away from livestock farming to something else? Because not so much beef and cows, but certainly pigs are an important part of your economy.
Well, if it comes to pigs, you can actually do a closed system where you do produce biogas from the waste product from the pigs. And so we invest heavily in biogas production as well, since it also reduces our use of natural gas. And so we do a lot of investments in different technologies that will combined reduce emissions from our agricultural sector.
It will increase prices of livestock, won't it?
Well, some of it might, but, you know, we are ahead in Denmark. And, you know, when we are doing a regulation on, for example, industries or the agricultural sector, we can see that Europe and other places are going along, and therefore the Danish companies and farmers will be strong in the, competitions in our green transition. And that's also one of the philosophies about the way we do politics in Denmark.
Fascinating story there from Denmark. Staying on a farming theme, there's disagreement among European Union members about whether to sign a deal with the Mercosur bloc of Latin American countries. That is another story that we have been following closely. Now, India's Supreme Court has criticised the authorities in Delhi for the delay enforcing restrictions to limit worsening air pollution. The judges said the measures should not be lifted without their permission. So how does it feel to be in Delhi at the moment? Here's our reporter, Jugal Ard Purohit, who's in the capital.
Walking around is frankly not advisable at this point. The advisory is to remain indoors. But what we can see from our windows, the environment all around is very dull. The visibility has reduced significantly. I'm barely able to look at the building next to us. Outside, a lot of people, in general though, you will see that the streets of Delhi are still full of traffic. There are still people who are outside, who are walking, going along their routines.
This, of course, is all having an economic impact. In 2019, it was estimated that smog cost India 1.36% of its GDP through premature deaths and the fact that people were struggling to work. Let's hear from some workers out in the capital, Delhi.
I come in every day at 6 a.m. with my cart to sell vegetables. Today, because of this pollution, there are very few customers. It's so uncomfortable, but this is my job, so I have to do it. Otherwise, where will I get the money from? 75% of my business is gone. I'm planning to go back to my village if this situation continues.
I drive this rickshaw and stay on the road for over 12 hours each day. And today, since the morning, my eyes are burning. I drink hot tea and water, but my body doesn't feel any different.
My eyes are stinging and I've been coughing, but I am a labourer, so I can't sit at home. I have to work.
Philip J. Landrigan is director of the Programme for Global Public Health and Common Good at Boston College. Philip, thanks so much for joining us here on the programme. We heard some of those voices there. The situation in Delhi at the moment, that smog, that pollution, it seems to be having an increasing impact on the public health of the city.
Yeah, unfortunately, the worst pollution in the world, the worst air pollution in the world is in the northern states of India, across the plain that runs east-west across the top of the country below the Himalaya Mountains. And it's due to a combination of two big things. Firstly, urban air pollution, cars, trucks, buses, and industrial establishments, plus this time of the year, each year, stubble burning in the farmers' fields.
Yeah, and we also have temperatures falling, which means that that pollution doesn't escape as quickly as it can do in the summer. It's important to stress here, isn't it, that we are beginning to know the impact on public health. And public health has economic consequences. If you don't have a healthy workforce, it's not economically able to provide as much as it should.
That's absolutely right. Air pollution is well known to cause chronic lung disease, heart disease, stroke, diabetes in adults, asthma, premature birth, stillbirths in children. All of those health effects have economic consequences. They run up healthcare costs. And when people are sick, when people are disabled, they can't work, they can't contribute to the economy. And a study that we did a few years ago out of Boston College indicated that the price tag for those health-related economic losses was $36.8 billion per year, which is almost 1.4% of India's GDP.
Has it surprised you since you did that study and you showed the huge economic cost that it was having that the situation hasn't got any better? It seems to be getting worse.
It is getting worse. We had hoped that publication of the economic data alongside the health data would persuade the government to take aggressive action. We've seen, for example, the government of China has moved aggressively to control urban air pollution, and their numbers are slowly getting better. They still got a way to go, but it's getting better. But by contrast, India has not taken action, and things are worsening.
Peter, I know we've had many different conversations on this program, but here is an example of a factor that is clearly linked to some extent to, I suppose, what's happening with the climate that people are working with that is having a massive economic consequence on one of the world's fastest growing economies.
Yes, and climate change and pollution are closely linked. We actually opined in our report that the economic cost of air pollution in India is so great that it could undercut India's aspiration to become a $5 trillion economy.
Really? Quickly, Philip, any solutions? What should India be doing? 30 seconds. What should it be putting in place to tackle this?
Well, India needs to follow the playbook that country after country around the world has put together. They identify their sources, they pass laws, they establish regulations, they enforce them, they find the violators, and they offer incentives to the people who do the right thing. Other countries, the UK, for example, have reduced air pollution by anywhere from 50 to 70% over the past 50 years.
Philip, thanks so much for joining us on the program. Peter, I just want to bring you in quickly here. It shows, doesn't it? We've had some interesting conversations on this program about energy security, but there is a cost, isn't there, when it comes to the climate of some of the policies that people follow?
There no doubt is. But I think there's also a cost to the mitigation that people talk about. There's a lot of focus on what's being lost because of these features, but very little focus on the costs of mitigating and working around it. So you need to look at both sides of the equation to do a cost-benefit analysis and decide what the right path is going forward.
Peter, as always, thank you for joining us here on World Business Report and guiding us through some of those economic stories. We'll continue this discussion on Business Matters at 0100 GMT.